All right, welcome to the Cava Ships podcast, where we try and cut through the fog and the murk and shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervello.
The Cava Ships podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is one of the largest AI, artificial intelligence, and machine learning federal contractors to the U.S. government. HII delivering the advantage.
Coming up, the 30-year shipbuilding plan, another shocking amphibious ship report, Gaza bridge preps, and more. Sam Lagrone of USNI News will be here to help us dive into all that and more. But first, a look at naval news this week.
Houthi forces continue to launch missiles, unmanned aircraft, and unmanned surface vessels at merchant shipping in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. U.S. and coalition forces destroyed most of the incoming Houthi weapons, including the downing by the French destroyer Alsace on March 21st of three Houthi ballistic anti-ship missiles over the Red Sea, apparently using Aster 30 long-range missiles. If true, that would mark the first combat use of a weapon from the widely used Aster family of missiles. The Alsace is operating with the European Union-led Operation Aspides to protect merchant shipping in the region.
Loaded with U.S. Army gear to create and support a Trident pier, the sea lift ship Roy P. Benavides left Newport News March 21st, headed for the eastern Mediterranean. The ship carries JLOTS, Joint Logistics Over-the-Shore gear, to be used to create a pier in Gaza. In addition to the Benavides, California-based Naval Beach Group 1 also is preparing to deploy aboard the sea lift ship's Second Lieutenant John P. Bobo and First Lieutenant Baldomaro Lopez to operate an INLS, Improved Navy Lighterage System, to move cargo from ships to the pier in Gaza. We'll talk more about this in the discussion portion of the show.
It was revealed March 18th that the United Kingdom does not intend to reactivate HMS Bulwark, one of the British Royal Navy's two large amphibious assault ships. Previously, the Navy's plan had been to refit HMS Bulwark to return to service in 2024 and relieve sister ship HMS Albion. The Royal Navy's profile for some years has been to keep one of those ships active while the other is in reserve and refit. Now, according to Minister of State for Defense Procurement James Cartledge, Bulwark will be, quote, regenerated from extended readiness and maintained so that she can easily be ready to deliver defense outputs if required. In 2023, a cost-cutting proposal to permanently decommission both Bulwark and Albion met with widespread opposition, as that would leave the Royal Navy with no effective way to deploy Royal Marines in a combat situation.
The Bataan Amphibious Ready Group, with the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit, returned to the U.S. East Coast beginning March 18th after an extended deployment to the European and Central Command theaters. The amphibious ships Bataan, Mesa Verde, and Carter Hall had been deployed since early July.
In new ship news, the fast response cutter USCGC David Duran, WPC 1156, was delivered March 18th to the U.S. Coast Guard at Key West, Florida. The David Duran will become the first of three fast response cutters to be based at Astoria, Oregon. And a keel ceremony was held March 20th for the towing, salvage, and rescue ship Muscogee Creek Nation, TATS-10, under construction at Bollinger Homa Shipyard in Homa, Louisiana.
And in old ship news, the battleship New Jersey was moved under tow March 21st from her normal berth at Camden, New Jersey, across the Delaware River to Philly Shipyard in Philadelphia, where the ship will undergo her first dry docking in many years. Philly Ship operates from a portion of the former Philadelphia Naval Shipyard, where the New Jersey was built beginning in 1940.
And we note the passing on March 20th of retired General Al Gray, a former sergeant and Vietnam combat veteran who rose to become the 29th Commandant of the Marine Corps. He was 95. General Gray spent 41 years in uniform and was Commandant from 1987 to 1991. Current Commandant General Eric Smith said Gray was a Marine's Marine, a giant who walked among us during his career and after, remaining one of the Corps' dearest friends and advocates, even into his twilight, he will absolutely be missed.
And that's a look at just some of this week's Naval News.
All right, we have a lot to dig into this week, and with us to help sort of sort it out is the editor of USNI News, Sam Legrone. Sam's an old friend of the podcast. Sam, welcome back to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
We're happy you're here. Let's start off with the 30-year plan, the Navy's 30-year shipbuilding plan, which is an annual affair. It's supposed to come out, it's supposed to be submitted along with the budget. It never is. But actually, this week, they weren't too bad. It was only about a week or so behind the budget. So it hit the streets on, I think, March 19th. You've gone into this deeply, read through it. It is a document that is chock full of information. What has popped at you about this?
I think the first thing is the recognition that submarine construction will be the number one thing the Navy's going to be thinking about for the next 40 years. So this year, when the plan came out, you had this bifurcated plan where if the Navy gets all the money, it's going to hit a goal of 381 ships in 2042. That's great. If they get flat budgets for shipbuilding construction, they're going to hit 345 ships in 2042. Honestly, all of that is up academic. But what you sort of see what by comparing and contrasting the two plans is that submarine construction remains the same. Ballistic missile submarine construction remains the same. And where the Navy's going to contemplating where it's going to take the pain, it's going to be in surface ships and combat logistics. So we see that. The other thing about the 30-year shipbuilding plan, probably the thing that is the most stable and predictable, is the decommissionings. And so there were 19 ships listed for decommissioning in the 30-year plan. Four cruisers, four Spearhead class transports, amphibious warship, a couple of LCSs, an expeditionary staging dock, which is essentially a kind of a transfer point from roll-on, roll-off stock to beach operations ashore. But it came as kind of a surprise because the Navy on the budget day the week before sort of presented is like, well, we're retiring 10 ships early to need. And I think everybody sort of kind of like glossed over. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, or 10 ships before the end of their expected service life. And they were like, oh, okay, great.
They were cute about it. And of course, now we're talking about just fiscal 2025, 19 ships in 2025. Yeah. And they said, well, we're decommissioning 10 ahead of need. You didn't say we're decommissioning 19. 10 of them are ahead of need. So they were being cute.
So, yeah. So there was a little, what do the magicians call it? Misdirection?
Sleight of hand or something. Yeah.
Sleight of hand. So, and I think probably the one thing, so there's, there's always a lot of pretty large decisions that are contained in tiny little paragraphs in the long range shipbuilding plan that sort of relate to the larger budget. You know, for example, it looks like they're kind of rethinking the role of the Freedom class LCS. Those are the ones that as of last year, they were looking to get rid of the entire fleet of those steel ships that Lockheed Martin built with Fink and Terry Marinette Marine up in Wisconsin. They're all going to be gone by the end of the decade. Well, maybe not so fast. So there's some movement there. And that was kind of buried in the report. Probably my number one favorite thing, though, again, a lot of this is academic. My number one favorite thing, though, is they have a list. There's a chart on the front end of the report on page 4, I think, where it says it has a breakdown of every single one of the 5 fleet plans the Navy has had since 2016. And I love that because it just shows you the amount of churn that has happened with the Navy and sort of thinking and rethinking and rethinking and rethinking of what an appropriate fleet looks like, and sort of seeing the contrast of all of those plans is pretty wild. So that's something that I think we're going to revisit later. But in terms
real quick, I pulled up the page. You made me pull up the page.
Right.
Sorry. So I'm just looking. So just in terms of, you know, battle force ships, these different plans since 2016 have jumped from 355, 355 ships to 390 to a range of 337 to 404 to 373, and now we're rock solid at 381.
Right.
But to, just to make your point, I don't know, numbers are numbers.
Oh, by the way, right. I would take any of those as somebody that was, you know, that grew up with 313, 300, right. three, that we never got to. I'll take any of that. Navy leadership, just, you know, like I would just love to get into the 320s.
Yeah, I think it's indicative of just the amount of churn around what shipbuilding should be and what exactly the appropriate fleet mix is, because again, nobody can pick a plan. Everybody wants to meddle.
I'm going to go to, you know, what's the number one thing industry says? You know, give us some stability. Give us a demand signal. You know, the Navy's beating up on the shipbuilding industry constantly for not having all the facilities that they want to build something. And yet, you guys, you don't know what you want year to year to year to year to year to year to year. And this has been going on for years and years and years and years. Where's your demand signal? Where's any consistency at all? And you want business to respond to this in an efficient, cost-effective manner.
I completely hear that argument from industry pretty constantly. I feel like every time I come on this podcast, a variation of that conversation comes up. I guess the only thing, you know, we could talk about any part of it that you'd like, but the only other thing that sort of stood out for me is that in the last two shipbuilding plans, I can't remember if it was two or three, there were actually three plans. There was the high-end plan for if the Navy had all the money. They had the low-end plan if budgets remained flat. And then they had a third plan, which we were described to, it was described to us as the CAPE plan, right? The OSD shipbuilding plan that had the submarine industrial base at one point build five submarines a year in the 2030s. Just some wildly optimistic figures. We actually talked to the CAPE director during the McAleese event a couple weeks ago. We asked her the question about, like, so by the way, you know, OSD has had a lot of influence and CAPE has had a lot of influence in the shipbuilding plan over the direction of it was going. And the CAPE plan was sort of different. And they were like, wait a second, there is no CAPE plan. CAPE is an advisory organization. We don't make decisions. We don't make policy. We are
as
here to go.
Yeah, there were snickers in the crowd.
I didn't hear that, but that was our question to CAPE, and CAPE said that we are just here to advise folks on best practices and just ask questions. So they did not take, even though several people have told us that that was the CAPE plan, they did not take responsibility that that was in fact their plan. So that was absent this year. That was probably the only other thing, but I know we got a lot to talk about, so.
Where's there the most concern that you've heard from folks? You know, is it that submarines are so prioritized? Is it that there are, you know, different ranges? What are you hearing that gives people heartburn?
Overall, with shipbuilding, I think the inability to go and meet the attack submarine goals, and in addition to the Columbia, I think that's the number one thing I think everybody's sort of really concerned about right now as an institution. I think I think when you look around, I think when PEO Submarines looks around, I think when NAVC looks around and says, hey, what is, how did we do this last time when we were building five Los Angeles class attack submarines a year? Where are those people? And they're like, well, they're not around anymore. How are we going to do this? And so I think there's a lot of churn, especially when it comes to figuring out what exactly they're going to do with a submarine industrial base. I mean, I think there's a lot of these suppliers that are kind of holding on with some very narrow margins. I think there's concerns from the shipbuilders that, in fact, you know, they're getting a lot of heat right now, especially from the Secretary of the Navy, that they are not doing enough to boost their production. And that finger is getting, you know, pointed directly at the shipyards. And I think the shipbuilders are like, hey, we're doing the best we can. We would love to hear some more clarity from, for example, from like for NAVC and the Navy on, you know, demand signal, because that's what we're running into. And that's on new construction. I mean, like shipbuilding, you know, not to be an apologist for the shipbuilders, but shipbuilding is a single digit margin business. I mean, you're not going, if I want to make all the money in the world, I'm not going into shipbuilding. So it's essentially, I think Todd Harrison told us this the other week, and we put it in our new subscribers only newsletter, USNI News Sea Scroll. Everybody get your $42 Naval Institute digital membership and get that because we got a bunch of stuff in there. We don't put in the paper. All right. You know, we had this quote from Todd Harrison, which is like, look, these shipbuilding is a public utility and it needs to be managed as such. And I think there's a lot of reflection of that's how the shipbuilders think of it. And I think when you talk to the Secretary of the Navy's people, they're like, well, we need to inject as much competition here as possible. So I mean, I think to start there, no one's on the same page of music in terms of these are the ships we need. This is the industrial base we need to maintain to go and do this, and this is the plan that we need to do to go and figure it out. I mean, like right now, what do we have? We have 1.3 Virginia attack boats being delivered a year in order to support AUKUS. That number needs to be 2.3. I think Canberra and the Australians were shaken a little bit when you looked at the budget that came out 2 weeks ago that had only one Virginia-class attack submarine. I think there were some people down in Australia that got a little nervous about this whole like decades-long commitment that they've signed up for in order to build submarines with the U.S. And then you're going to have you know, at least three submarine Virginia class submarines that will be built in the United States go to the Australians before they run up with their own program with the Brits to build their native nuclear submarine. So yeah, I think again, who's in charge? What's the direction? Is everybody pulling in the same direction? You know, there's kind of, and I know it's a longer answer than you probably wanted to, but I think the submarine industrial base, I think, is number one forefront on everybody's minds. And then where can we build the other stuff in the margins? Like in terms of surface ships and combat logistics ships.
Well, I think AUKUS, you know, if anybody thinks that the current AUKUS build plan is actually what's going to happen, good for you. I wouldn't put a penny into it. In any case, let's move on. I want to talk briefly about the DECOM list, taking ships away. We just said 19 ships this year. Also, on March 11th, the Navy very quietly put out its 2024 inactivation list. We're already in 2024. This is a list that, on a normal year, would have come out almost a year ago. Last May, really, is was sort of the normal time. So the fact that it wasn't there was indicative of something, not having made a decision or not wanting to have that decision out there. I think it's more the other one because there's five ships on it, an attack submarine, the San Juan, which is not unexpected. Two cruisers, Antietam and Lady Gulf, which were already people thought were going this year, but there's two cruisers on there, the Vicksburg and the Calpins, who are were two of the seven cruisers that were inducted into the cruiser modernization program, and those two ships have been out of service since 2015. The Navy's been working on them, paying money for those ships to be upgraded, refitted, overhauled. They've spent almost $1 billion between those two ships to put them back. And now, with never having gotten a single return on it, they're going to get them throw them away. Congress objected. The Vicksburg by name was named as a ship the Navy may not dispose of, even though they keep putting the name out every year. But I think this year, they've quietly, very quietly, shh, don't tell anybody, gotten Congress to go along with this and work. I'm told reliably that work on both the Calpins in San Diego and the Vicksburg in Norfolk stopped some weeks ago, and they've both been moved and now are actively in the act process. So that's a major investment that the country got zip on, and it's not going to be the last we've heard of that. The cruisers, by the way, still all gone, no matter who they are, by 2027, and that is in line with the plan that was out last year. The year after that, they'll start decommissioning Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. Excuse me. Aside from that, what if anything really popped at you, Sam? I know you talked about LCSs. It looks like they are done. There's no more, except for the very early Fort Worth LCS-3, which is a ship that's out of spec with everybody else. There are no more Freedom Class LCSs on this list, so they're going to stick with LCSs. But well, is it 10 ships, I think, beginning with LCS-13, and then every other number through 31. And that seems to be in there. But anything else popped out? You mentioned something about EPFs.
Yeah, so the EPF is the
high speed
Spirit.
Transport.
Yeah, the high speed transport. So these are aluminum ships that they're made in Austell, USA. This is something that the Navy, in particular the Marine Corps, has been interested in for a while. The idea that like I have an intra theater connector that can go real fast, and they're based on these Hawaiian super fast ferries that go and run people all over the place at like 45 knots. I mean, they're pretty quick. So it's been a pretty they've been with the Military Sealift Command, and they're still chunking them out over at Austell, USA. Well, they quietly took the first two, Spearhead and Choctaw County, and those are in Philadelphia right now. Those are kind of just like have been mothballed. They don't really have a crew. They're just there. And no one made a big deal out of it when that actually happened. And the ships are out there. I depending on who you talk to, they're underutilized for some of the missions and the roles that they could be used for. They've got a big old cargo deck. They've got a ramp. They don't draft very much. And they can go a lot of different places. So if you're thinking of General Hackle over at the Marine Corps, who's in charge of their requirements and kind of their big thinking in terms of warfighting, was like, hey, I need more platforms to run Marines around. And we really like the Spearhead class, and we really like LCSs and stuff like that. Why don't we put Marines on them and stuff like that? So you're starting to have this conversation about alternative force designs for the Marine Corps, and they're looking for platforms because they don't have a lot of L-class ships. Well, here's a platform that they really like is going away without any kind of like real good explanation as to why. And Austell is still building them. They're going to transition very shortly into the EMS variant, which are going to be sort of not the replacement for the hospital ships, but essentially you're going to take this twin hull catamaran and you're going to turn it into like the ambulance of the sea that can tear ass around the Pacific and show up in places and patch people up, you know, and take them in by B-22s. But with a platform that everybody seems to like so much, all of a sudden the first four are just going away. And there's not really much of an explanation for that, which I think is really interesting. The other thing on the DCOM list, you know, sort of in the same vein with the cruisers, is the Helena. The Helena is a submarine. It's a Los Angeles class submarine, SSN 725. And it completed its last deployment in 2017. Well, the Helena was an early experiment for the four public U.S. shipyards are backed up, right? The number one thing they got to work on is the boomers, right? The ballistic missile submarines. And then the aircraft carriers. And then after that, you got the attack submarines. Well, there's not enough room in the four public yards for the attack submarines. So we're going to look at new construction yards at Newport News, HII's Newport News, and then Electric Boat at Bath to go and work on these submarines to get them back into circulation. Well, Helena was one of the early experiments for this. The Boise is the other one that's probably a little bit more famous. But they spent $260 odd million on Helena. They completed all of the stuff over at Newport News, moved it over to Naval Station Norfolk, and now it is on the decommissioning list without deploying since 2017. So what are they? They're going to decommission it in 2025. Are they going to deploy it before then? Submarine forces, they were like, well, we will be employing with an E the submarine until its decommissioning date. So there's another example of you put a bunch of maintenance money into a particular hull, and then looks like you're not actually going to go and deploy it.
Let's shift gears a little bit from the plans to build and the plans to decom to ships that are struggling a bit at the pier. Out this week, came news of the Boxer, USS Boxer, Big Deck Amphib out in San Diego. The command investigation was posted a number of places. Sam, you and Chris have been following this closely. What do you take away from that command investigation? And then I'll ask you, like, to put it into the context of the Bonhomme Richard and other amphib woes, you know, beyond just the ship itself. What does this tell us about the state of big deck amphibs writ large?
So the command investigations, one of them was from Chris, correct me if I'm wrong here. One of them was from January and the other one was from late last year. And it was looking into two specific sort of sets of instances on the USS Boxer. So the more recent one, three. Yeah. Okay. So probably the most egregious one was the engineering division on the Boxer, according to these investigations, was dysfunctional, I think is probably the nicest way to say it. And you had instances of assault down there that were unspecified. You had a pretty undisciplined crew down there. And then they just weren't particularly good at their jobs. And I think probably the most striking example, and I think this is the one everybody else highlighted, is they ran during sea trials after they got done with their availability. They ran one of the main reduction gears without lube oil for 2 hours on an underway period. So for those who don't know, the main reduction gear is probably one of the most important mechanical components on any ship. So it translates your the energy from your prime movers or your big engines down to your props. I mean, it is one of the quintessential pieces of machinery on the ship. And these things are huge. The one on there's two on the Boxer, and it's like, they're two stories high. They're, you know, it's with essentially, they're not quite a Rolex, but they're not far off in terms of like complicated mechanical, or they're probably more complicated than a Rolex. So breaking that is maybe one of the worst things you could do on a ship. And they ran it without lubrication for 2 hours. And that's egregious. And then on top of that, they didn't inform the command leadership that that had actually happened for another 24 hours. So you have all sorts of problems with the efficacy of your engineering division. And then on top of that, what kind of relationships do you have with your command that you're not able to tell them a critical component? You don't feel that you don't have the imperative to tell the command, or you're afraid, or for whatever reason, that you're not going to tell the command that you did something really, really bad for almost a whole day.
I want to break up. So, I mean, even put this into context, this is the same fleet, the same base, the same organization that I'm going to say aloud, because I think that's true. A sister ship, the Bonhomme Richard, to burn for 4.5 days pier side and now is a lost ship. That was an appalling display by everybody involved of incompetence. This ship has had problems going on for over a year. They were supposed to have deployed. The Boxer should be out in the Western Pacific at least somewhere. They're not supposed to be in San Diego still running sea trials. They're not just late. They missed their bus. The Marines, the upper command echelons are trying to figure out how to mix and match and patch the absence of the Boxer Amphibious Ready Group with the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit from operating as a unit in the Western Pacific. Two of the three ships are still in San Diego, broken. One, the Somerset in LPD, Amphibious Transport, is deployed, but essentially, she's actually, last I saw, was in Thailand doing Cobra Gold exercises. And they're essentially on an independent deployment which is not supposed to be. So there's all this chaos going on. This was the MUARG that's supposed to be deployed right now. At the moment, there is no MUARG deployed. Where's the Boxer? The Boxer is broken. And, you know, the stuff that's in this command report, all watch standards displayed an appalling lack of procedural compliance and general complacency in the casualty. Like, whatever. And especially falling on the heels of you lost a ship, a 40,000-ton ship burned in the heart of one of your biggest naval bases for 4.5 days, and you lost it. You would think, I'm sorry, kids, you would think that if anybody would be paying attention, if anybody should be on top of this stuff, it would be the amphibious force out of San Diego. And I don't understand how this can happen. And if somebody takes offense at that, I really don't care, because it's our Navy, it's everybody's Navy, and you're supposed to take care of your ships. And I don't understand this. This is jaw-dropping stuff, particularly in the continuum of Bonham Richard was just a few years ago. And I mean, I don't know how you get there. Chris, I mean, what's your take on this? I mean, you're especially in your job in the Navy, you would have had to be part of, I don't know, explaining to silly people like me how this could happen.
It's hard for me to wrap my mind around that. It's one thing when we've ridden these ships hard and, you know, we haven't had a chance to do all the maintenance and so stuff breaks. That is a logical explanation that I think smart people like you and Sam tend to buy and your readers tend to buy. When you look into this report and you see just the egregious lack of professionalism as identified by the investigating officer and as concurred by the commanding authority, boy, it's hard to understand how this could happen. Especially in light of Bonhomme Richard. And that's what I mean. I mean, this would have been bad enough on its own, hard to imagine. But then, you know, just a few months after the Bonhomme Richard, when the light is supposed to be on amphibious forces in San Diego and around the fleet, I just don't see what's going on and how you get to this.
Do you have a sense? So probably been 25 years now. I was part of the coverage of a story on an AOE, a fast supply ship, that had a terrible in-service inspection. It was just in horrible shape. Like, how did this happen? And one of the fallouts from that report and that situation was that the Navy really wasn't taking care of these ships. And now this is a key to a deployed battle group. How do you keep a deployed strike group, carrier strike group, supplied at sea? It's through one of these fast supply ships, not an inconsequential unit. But it turned out that the Navy they didn't really care about it. A lot of people went, what do you want? It's an oiler. It's just a bunch of knuckle draggers on that ship. They were assigning pretty much not your best people, the most pleasant way to put it, to these ships routinely. And you just had a degradation of quality in the kind of person and the kind of officer and seaman that was being assigned to the ships. That changed. And a fleet commander came up to me about a year or two later to talk about it and said, you know, at the time you guys ran that story and I was really, really, really annoyed. But you know what? You were right. And we've made a lot of changes. And actually, if you hadn't run that story, probably nothing would have happened. And I'm just reminded of that what's going on is, I mean, I like amphibs. My father was a gator, you know, amphibious ships. This is important stuff. But you read this report. Is that something? Are they not assigning good people to amphibs? It's not the sexy, Aegis ship that everybody wants to be on.
I mean, there's always a little bit of that, competition between the DDG and CG Navy and the Amphib Navy in terms of where the talent goes. I mean, I would have liked to have thought that we were beyond that. I guess if I look at it and really have to try hard to find an excuse, I just think it's that I don't believe our leadership knows how to be both effective at sea and in maintenance periods and then at sea again, right? I mean, I just don't think, I think that we have some blind spots going from at sea to maintenance and then maintenance to back at sea. And so you tend to see these lapses as ships come out of the yards because the leadership is just not used to it. You typically don't become the commanding officer of a ship or a well-respected department head because of your experience in the shipyards and because of your experience in the basic phase. You're judged on your operational prowess. And so I think if you look across the fleet, but particularly in the amphib fleet, you see some problems as these ships start to come out of maintenance. And so the ability to kind of have that accountability and that oversight, you see blind spots.
I think the only thing I'd add there is that if you look in the investigation, the senior enlisted sailor in the engineering division, that role was gapped. If you saw that, I look at, that's when I read these command investigations, and it's been a lot. The first thing I go to is just like, all right, where's the chief's mess involved in this, right? Where is the senior enlisted person? How senior were they? How much experience they had? And 9 times out of 10, that's either going to be a very junior chief that was part of that, or that position was gapped. I mean, I think I'm, I think it's a kind of a, a thing for us, especially when we're looking at some of these personnel issues, is that senior enlisted leadership is so critically important. And I don't think it's talked about enough, especially, sort of in the kind of the DC area in which we live in, especially when we're focusing on sort of the plight of the junior sailor and then sort of the policy imperatives of the Admiralty. Like, where is that senior enlisted person in this?
Yeah, it's an important point. And without that leadership, you have problems like this. It's you see it time in and time again.
We could talk about this for a long time, but
Yeah.
sadly, we could talk about this for a long time. Let's move on and talk about the Middle East. So there were some interesting developments this week. The first ship, the American ship, sea lift ship, loaded with big gear, to build this bridge in Gaza, left Newport News this week. The Benavides, actually, Sam, you were just down there. You
I was
visited the
just.
ship, yeah. And this ship was, I want to hear about that. This is the ship. There are actually three big sea lift ships that are going. The Benavides is carrying primarily army gear. They're going off now. Two more are coming. Second Lieutenant John P. Bobo, First Lieutenant Baldomero Lopez. They are going to be carrying the naval support group here, led by Naval Beach Group One, that will be operating the INLS, the Navy Improved Lightering System, which is designed to move cargo from ships offshore to the pier that the Army will build that will actually connect to the shore. Those two ships have not left yet. They're still setting up. Sam, you went down and saw the Benavides. It's now gone. It's en route. What did you see when you were down there?
Well, I saw the Benavides, and I also saw the army ships when they left from
Right.
Port Eustis a couple of days before. So it was really interesting to kind of compare and contrast. So the army keeps its joint logistics over the shore gear in Fort Eustis kind of almost ready to go. So these are big Lego looking blocks that you can load up on train cars, and they're foldable. And you can move them relatively easily. So what they did was they put all of the causeway stuff. So Fort Eustis is about 18 miles up the river from where Newport News is where Benavidez was. And so they built up these giant causeway blocks, and they just floated them down the river, Mark Twain style, with these warping tugs, which I've never seen before, which are essentially, they look like a big piece of causeway with like a toll booth on it. And there are these powered tugs that moved the whole thing. So they floated the whole bunch down, everything they're going to need for this pier in Gaza, down to the Benavides. So I caught them on the front end when they were assembling the thing on Tuesday, and then on the back end last week on Thursday or Friday, when they were getting the Benavides up. So the Benavides is huge, right? It was one of these roll-off ships that the Navy had built for the Army to kind of take tanks from here to the front lines, either in Europe and the Middle East. And they are massive. They are huge. So you're talking about a cargo deck that's meant for vehicles that is the size of about four super Walmarts, kind of all mashed together. And then on the front end, or I'm sorry, on top side, you've got a bunch of storage areas there, and they have these huge 50-ton cranes, and they can operate in tandem. So you can quad lift and lift up to about 140 tons on and off. So there's a lot of capability in that individual ship. So the concept of operations is when you don't have like a dock. So they have this big stern door that you can roll off and roll off, roll on and roll off stuff, and it's pretty versatile, and you can pretty much do it anywhere. So what they're going to do with the army stuff on Benavidez is they're going to go get about 2 or 3 miles offshore because the thing's big. It drafts like 34 feet. And they're going to assemble kind of a staging area for the pier, we understand. They call it the roll-on, roll-off discharge zone or discharge area. And it's essentially a floating dock about the size of a football field. You can make them really big. And they're going to use that as a staging point to go and assemble the army pier. And they're going to move that stuff 2 miles, 2 to 3 miles inshore into a point that has yet to be determined in Gaza. So we had a briefing with a senior Navy official this week talking about what the Navy's contribution is going to be. And so Bobo and Lopez are going to be coming out of Florida, and they're going to have sort of the Navy equivalent of this stuff, of these kind of Lego pieces to build this together. And the way that the Navy is describing what the Beach Group is going to do is the Navy is going to build this floating pier in the middle of the Eastern Mediterranean, and that's where they're going to offload the cargo. So it's going to come from Cyprus. It's going to go to this spot 2 miles-ish off the shore that the Navy's building. The Army has one, and they rolled out with one on Benavidez, and the Navy has one. How that works, TBD. So they're going to have this big pier, and they're going to offload all the cargo there. Not a pier, that this big floating dock in the middle of the ocean. They're going to unload the cargo there, and then they're going to load them on the Army watercraft. And then the watercraft is going to take it from this thing 2 miles away from the pier and then drive it to the pier, and then they'll offload it there. Where this gets complicated is the White House has made some guarantees that there will be no boots on the ground, no US troops in Israel. So to be determined who's going to be doing force protection, to be determined who's going to be distributing the food, to be determined how are you going to prevent a bunch of Hamas guys from rushing the pier, grabbing some soldiers, and whisking them away somewhere, which is probably the worst case scenario. How are you going to ensure that civilians don't rush it looking for food, and then that turns into an international incident? All of that is being determined. We don't even know yet who's the partner on the other end who's going to go and like stake the pier down. You know, you could drive it into the shore, but someone needs to like, you know, tie something to a davit somewhere saying it's not going anywhere. So that's to be determined how the screening process is working with the Israelis in Cyprus. Don't know that either. But there's some time to figure this out because when the army guys left last week, it's the 7th Transportation Brigade Expeditionary. It's a subordinate unit of the 18th Airborne Corps. Those folks are going to get there in about another 3 weeks. It's a 30-day transit in a flat-bottom boat that goes 10 knots in the Atlantic in the springtime. So for the saltier folks out there, you know what that means. It's going to be a rough ride. We talked to one of the we talked to one of the chief warrant officers that drive the boats. That's the other thing. If we have time at USNI News, I really want to do a piece on Army watercraft culture because, like, I nerded out when I was on the pier there, and I asked a lot of questions. It's like, so wait, what's your wardroom culture like? Wait, what do you mean
No
there's officers?
officers. That's
No
right.
officers. Yeah, so it's chief warrant officers, and they call them chiefs, and it kind of broke my brain a little bit.
This is cool, Sam. Just real quick. I mean, in 2008, the Navy tested its version, the improved Navy lighterage system, as part of Africa Partnership Station. We were doing a WATSE, West African Training Cruise, off of Liberia, and we did the at sea part with the Marines. I was on that cruise with then Captain, now retired, 3-star John, now was the Commodore. We did this. We did the two ships. We connected Bobo. And we connected Fort McHenry together, and they drove ships on and off. And then the watercraft from the beach unit, the beach unit took the supplies into Liberia, and we delivered humanitarian supplies. So to see that come together, now I can't imagine now adding the army piece to it. Boy, this is going to be something to see there in the Mediterranean.
and there's still a lot to be determined, like who's in charge. That's a
Right.
pretty that you know, and so the army guys, you know, when you push them on some of these specifics, it's like, well, for operational security concerns, we can't talk about force protection. I was just like, yeah, you know, because I'm looking at like some very rusty 50 cal emplacements right here. Like, I don't know what y'all got here.
That's code for we'll figure it out on
We'll
the
figure it
transit
out.
over. Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
Sam, we're going to have to stop it there. Thank you very much for joining us. We really did cover the globe and the big issues that are going on. Thank you again, and hope you will come back in a few weeks and we can do this again.
Absolutely. Posture season is fast approaching. I'm here in mid-April, so it sounds like the Navy sessions are going to be happening right during the middle of Sierra Space. So that'll be fun for everyone.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again.
All right, thank you.
Now hear this. Now hear this.
All right, Mr. Civello has some thoughts on the newly announced resignation from Representative Mike Gallagher.
Earlier this year, Mike Gallagher shocked many of his supporters and fans by announcing that he would not seek re-election. Now, literally minutes before this recording, the Wisconsin Republican took it one step further, deciding to leave Congress not at the end of his term in January, but on April 19th. We've been very lucky on this podcast to get to know Congressman Gallagher as a guest, as a navalist, and as a great guy who loves his country and wants what's best for the armed services and those who serve in it. While I have no doubt that Mike will continue to have an impact on national security after leaving Congress, his retirement leaves a Ford-class carrier-sized hole in the Armed Services Committee and among those members that actually get it. There has been no better friend to navalists, to China hawks, and to those who seek to return responsible and sane politics than Mike Gallagher. Fair winds and following seas, Congressman. Thank you for your leadership and passion. We look forward to helping you continue to play a substantive role in naval and national security issues in your next chapter of service.
I completely agree with you, Chris. I think he was just a real American. He really tried to bridge the gap between parties, between factions of all sorts, and he really enjoyed comity was the I think the word it just means people can get along. We can disagree, but we can also get along. And a lot of respect for Congressman Gallagher. Well, that does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vagha Mohradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support. The Cavra Ships podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and America's only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII delivering the advantage.
Be sure to follow us at Cavra Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cabas. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.